So this is from Gyalgo Kyentse Rinpoche. So he was one of Sangharakshita's teachers, Sangharakshita, founder of the Tree Rat movement. A thought does not intrinsically possess any solidity, form, shape, or colour. For example, when a strong feeling of anger arises in the mind, with such force that you want to fight and destroy someone, is the angry thought holding a weapon in its hand? Could it lead an army? Might it burn anyone like a fire, crush them like a stone, or carry them away like a raging river? No. Anger, like any thought or feeling, has no true existence. It cannot even be definitely localized anywhere in your body, speech, or mind. It is like wind in empty space.
Om Amida Vri. Om Amida Vri. Om Amida Vri. Om Amida Vri. Om Amida Vri.
Just you know the format for this evening. In a minute I'm going to say something about this new phase that we're moving into with the Tuesday nights. Yeah, of course, yeah. Oh, even the door, that can let through a good breeze.
It's locked.
Ah, yeah.
Is it?
No, there's a key. No, the door's not locked, just push it, yeah. There's a brick there. Prop it open with.
It's a high tech game, isn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, in a minute I'm going to introduce our new phase in the series of the Mandala of Practice, receptivity. And then we're going to have, straight after that, we're going to split into discussion groups. So, just talking about this. So we could have, if there are new people who come off the intro course,
there's only three people, I think, today.
Three people, okay. Okay. Is that three including you, or...?
No, not
really. Okay. So, well, we could, if you want to, have a small group for the intro course. And then a women's group, and I don't know if we want to do a men's group, or we could do a mixed group. Who would prefer to do a mixed group? Okay, I'll take it. You might be outnumbered there, Jay. Right, so we'll do a men's group and a women's group. Women's group in here, men's group in the reception room, and then we'll do the people in the intro course in the bookshop area with Ben and I think Pranirati. Yeah, okay. And then that should take us to about 8:45, and we'll have a short break in silence. Just a leg scratch, or if you need to go and use the toilet, comfort break. And then we'll come back straight back into here for a meditation, and we'll do the meditation. And it should all end about 9:30. Best laid plans of mice and men. And then we have the tea break at the end, and you can leave when you want to. Okay. Right. Do I want to stand? Do I want to sit? Decision. I think I'll stand.
Do you want the lectern?
Yeah, right. Something to hide behind and... So yes, we've arrived at this phase of the mandala of practice, or the system of practice, Trivatna system of practice, called receptivity. As this is a mandala, it's not strictly a linear progression. So with a mandala, there's a sense of wholeness about it, and a sense of everything happening outside of time, as it were. So how could you describe that? So with a little analogy. Is that right? Yeah, so a mandala is like a circle of people sitting on chairs who are at the same time all sitting on each other's laps. Chew on that one for a bit. But for the sake of convenience, we can talk about it as a linear progression. So we started with integration. Got ourselves integrated through the practice of ethics and mindfulness and meditation. Brought all our disparate energies together into some sort of whole. Focused our minds And the mind has gone from being unwieldy to being wieldy, or at least more wieldy, i.e. it's no longer completely at the mercy of the seeming random movements that go on within it. And we've developed some positive emotion through the practice of the Metta Bhavana, or the Brahma and the Brahmaviharas, or the other aspects of Metta. And we've developed some warmth and positivity and expanded our mind's horizons in the process. So we're no longer subject to the vicissitudes of the mind, at least not as much, through having practiced integration and positivity. And the tendency of the mind to sort of lurch around in these kind of extremes of reactivity that it does. We've worked through some of that push-pull of the ordinary mind and opened up the heart. In a sort of metaphorical sense, we've opened up the heart. And also through the practice of the Metta Bhavana, we've dissolved, to some extent, the tendency for the mind to polarise around what it sees and experiences. And this is particularly in the way it's most relevant to us as human beings in our relationships with other people through the stages of the Metta Bhavana. And now comes a stage of receptivity. And in a way, receptivity is of the whole mandala, the five aspects of it, is the one that's least like a stage. I don't mean least like a theatrical stage, I mean least like a stage in the five processes. Although maybe it's more like the stage, actually. We can see that receptivity sits behind all of the other stages. That's one way of looking at it. So without receptivity, we can't open to deeper levels of our experience through meditation, etc. And without receptivity, our cup is already full, unable to receive the new. So in some ways, the practice of integration and positive emotion is what's making us receptors. It's opening us up, it's emptying our cup, practice of ethics, practice of study, etc. But more deeply, you could say that receptivity is the opposite of the grasping, egoic mind. So, in Buddhism, what we call the ego is the tendency for us to reference and think the world back to some sort of inner self or some idea of an inner self. And off we go. That's how we can proceed in life. Usually very unconsciously, we're just sort of born into the tendencies of the egoic mind. And you can see the whole of Buddhism, in a way, is working to, let's say get rid of the egoic mind, but to see through the egoic mind and the shapes that it makes that close down our experience and restrict our experience and restrict our ability to love particularly. I think Sangharaksha once said that the ego is the closedness to new experience. So if you see receptivity as being the opposite of the egoic mind, you could see that a receptivity is the openness to new experience. Generally speaking, as human beings, we don't tend to like new experience. Well, we do sometimes, you know, when it kind of suits us. But change is something that we're not generally very good with. So there we are. It's receptivity is a general principle and a quality that's needed within all the stages. It's also been spoken of by Sangharakshita, if you're interested, in somewhere in the seven papers by Subhuti. He talks about this as the goal of the path as well. So it's the underlying quality we need. It sort of sits at the back of everything, but it's also could be seen as being equivalent to the goal. So, how do we become more receptive? And as I said, you know, practicing integration and positive emotion brings us into a greater receptivity. And also, we're going to explore receptivity over the next, it's actually probably 7 weeks, but there's the August break in between. So we're running up to the end of July, and then the centre shuts. I think it's from the 3rd of August to the 4th of September or something like that. Yeah, something like that. And then we start again on Saguenay, I think, on the 4th of September. There's a couple more, and then a couple of other things are going to happen before we go into the next phase of spiritual death. Where was I? So, yes, but how we become more receptive? We're also receptive to what? So this latter, the receptive to what? Well, we could start by saying that the stage or aspect of receptivity is where we start to make the transition into wisdom. So the stages of ethics and the stages of meditation, those are represented by integration, positive emotion, etc. And we make the transition into wisdom. And the stages of wisdom are going to be more fully explored through the part of the mandala, the series that's on spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So receptivity could be seen to be preparing us for this stage of spiritual death, which is the first of this two-part transition into wisdom awakening, and the second part being spiritual rebirth. So, the question is receptive to what? So, before we go there, or kind of as we go there, I'm going to sort of dispel or put to bed, hopefully, a few myths or ideas around this. So some of this might be a little bit tricky, but perhaps there's no easy way out of it. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is self-power and other power. So we've got these two ideas. I don't know whether they're in the tradition as such, but certainly Sangharakshita has talked about these two ideas of self-power and other power. So many religions in the world have the idea of God. So God with a capital G, or gods. And to cut a very long story short, the way most people, most of us, these gods appear to us is as external agents, yeah. So we have the Orthodox Christian God, for instance, that appears as, in our popular imagination, often as the old man in the sky. I remember watching this film, it was a film of Bob Dylan, but it had the poet Allen Ginsberg in it, and he was in a play, they were together, and they went to this playground where these kids, and they went to the sort of railings of the playground, these kids came running up, and Allen Ginsberg asked them, "What does God look like?" Which I thought was wonderful, because their answers were like, "Yeah, he's an old man, you know, in the sky, and he's got a white beard." And Allen Ginsberg kept on sort of pulling more out of them their idea of God, you know, the idea of God, at least in Middle America in the 1960s. So we have this Orthodox Christian God, for instance. Often in our emotional relationship to this idea of God, if we've been exposed to that idea, we see it as a separate being. Yeah. The more sophisticated ways of talking about God, but ultimately, for most of us, this idea of God has come across as the idea of other, and that something that has power over us. So then we have another popular idea, and that is that there is no God, and there's just man, and the world appears as it appears to the senses. And in this world, perhaps we see that there is no intrinsic meaning, but that we can live in this world with better or worse directions and attitudes. And that the awareness of this and the capacity to do something about this, our attitudes and directions, is in our own hands. We are the primary agent of what happens. So this is the idea of self-power, other power and self-power. So what does Buddhism think? Well, it would say that neither of those points of view truly represents the way things are. Buddhism doesn't agree with the idea of an ultimate God, as in an external creator or arbiter of existence. Nor does it believe in the absolute nature of an agency of the self. You might be surprised to believe or hear. So what is it that we are making ourselves receptive to when we're talking about receptivity? Well, in some ways, it is not the answer but the question that's the difficulty. What do we mean, for instance, by the word we? Is our notion of us, ourselves, we, what we think it is? We're looking at the nature of our assumptions, deeply held notions, so deep that we can hardly see them, as to the nature of what is going on. Again, to cut a short, long story short, we need to be looking in the right place to see what we really are. So this is what Buddhism attempts to accomplish. It tries to point us to the right place to look. So the Buddha is famously known for not even getting involved and caught up in philosophical debates. And maybe one of the reasons for that is because that would be looking in the wrong place. So we could say that we are caught in a bit of a dilemma. We want to see, but the way we are looking, or where we are looking from, is itself a deluded point of view, such that whatever we see is then informed by this view. But behind these deluded views, Buddhism says, there exists the true nature of things and the perception of the true nature of things. And it's possible to perceive things from that point of view. So there is hope. This, we could say, is what or where we are trying to open up to when we're being receptive. So this might sound a little bit difficult, like a difficult number to achieve. You know, how do you see when the point of view you're seeing from is the thing that you're trying to see through, as it were? So one of the ways that Buddhism tries to point out this place is what are called the teachings on emptiness. So one form of which we recite in the Heart Sutra of the Puja. So the emptiness teachings are an extension of the Buddha's teaching of the three lakshanas, or marks of conditioned existence, which we cover on the introductory course. So, you know, even in 6 weeks of being in the Buddhist Center, you could have already encountered this. So, and particularly within that, the lakshana, or the mark of conditioned existence, called insubstantiality. So let's be clear. Emptiness here does not mean annihilationism. Yeah. So this is distinctly rejected by the Buddha and Buddhist teaching. So by annihilationism, we mean the idea that there is nothing, that life is empty and meaningless, and when you die, everything just goes blank. That would be a kind of form of annihilationism, the belief in that. But it's interesting often that when we think about this idea, if we've been exposed to this idea of Buddhism, of emptiness, that is often our reaction, that we think, that means everything's going to kind of, you know, emptiness, sounds terrible. Empty. So one important thing to always remind oneself with Buddhism, I think, is that it's completely methodological. So it's really concerned with trying to point you to the place of seeing, point you to the place of freedom, of liberation, liberation from suffering, particularly. But it's methodological. So the man who was very famous for developing the emptiness teachings, or one of the people who's very famous for it, was someone called Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna said that the whole of the teachings of the emptiness teachings of Buddhism, the Pranayaparamita, perfection of wisdom, are all methodological. So they're all getting to point us in a particular way, a finger pointing at the moon. So by emptiness in this context, what is meant is that we make the mistake of thinking that there are permanent substantial things and objects, people, ideas, entities, where there are none. Yeah? Not that there is nothing. And in a way, the idea of emptiness is balanced on the side of getting us to look, because usually we're thinking the other way. We're thinking that things are substantial and permanent. And this emptiness teaching is trying to kind of point to the other direction. It's not a literal description of the way things are. In fact, in one way, it'd be better to say appearance emptiness as a way of describing that. So why do we have this reaction when we come across these ideas of emptiness? Well, the question could be rephrased as, why does the egoic mind not like emptiness, and why does the awakened heart like emptiness? Sorry, there aren't many jokes in this talk. Well, it's not all getting too heavy. I'll try and throw one in if I can. So let's try and create these two worlds, yeah, as it were, so that we can get a better idea, a better feeling for this. Yeah. So from our point of view, we see the world in terms of labels and concepts. We then manage this world from the point of view of the concepts we have created. Yeah. So we see the world in terms of labels and concepts. We then manage this world from the point of view of the concepts we have created. So I say, pass me the salt, please, and you know what to do. Of course, when we're infants, we don't do that. We have to learn this word salt and what it means, and it's referring to an object, you know, in awareness. And so, when we were infants, this world is confusing, and we may get confused about categories. You know, we might pass the pepper instead, at least until we learn that the salt is the white one. And as we get older, the world of objects and signs gets more and more complex, to the point where we can do things like we are doing now. Someone talking about the nature of experience and reality, or trying to. And we are hopefully, depending to the extent that we've understood the categories under discussion, able to grasp what's being said, get some idea of what is meant. Usually this is only on the intellectual level. For instance, where someone says the word reality, and we have some idea of what that means. We know in the area of deep questions, the true nature of things, Buddhism, philosophy, what is and what is not. We may also be aware that though we know this word, we're not completely sure if we know what this thing refers to. Yeah. So this is all well and good and helps us to manage in this manifest world and to keep ourselves safe and to accomplish things like passing the salt. So in one way, thingness is not a problem. Yeah. Thingness. This idea of sort of seeing everything in terms of things. And yet, is it? Yeah? Is thingness not a problem on the ordinary level? But I think thingness is apparent in our everyday experience, what it is. When something breaks, we get frustrated. Though rationally, we know that things inevitably stop working at some point, unless they were built before 1960. That joke. Actually wrote joke there. in case you didn't get it. Deep down, we don't accept this, yeah? Otherwise, if we did, it wouldn't be a problem. It's broken? Well, of course it's broken. This, of course, goes very deep. The body becomes broken. The mind, too, can become broken, the thinking mind. So why would this be a problem? This, Buddhism would say, or one of the ways it would say, is because we cling to things. We are already clinging to the cup that is in our hand and has just cracked. More so if it's our favourite cup. Moreover, we cling to the idea that there really are such things as cups in a sort of permanent, abstract kind of way. Without this clinging, we usually feel terrified. Yeah? Am I in a floating world of breakable things or things that don't last? Am I a part of this world of things that don't last? Am I afraid of death? Furthermore, this world of things we look to make us happy. So there could be a question here about happiness. What is it that we want from the object, person, idea that we are holding or seeming to hold? We want something. After all, we've made some effort, maybe a great effort, to get hold of it. Might even been a job of a lifetime to get hold of this thing or this collection of things, often called our life. Well, this something could be described broadly as happiness, to feel good, not to feel bad. You want some sort of ultimate fulfillment, secure, free from pain, permanent and lasting. And then we get this thing, or seem to get it. Then we seem to feel good, at least for a while. But then we soon move on to the next thing. The feeling good isn't lasting or ultimate. Or else why would we continue to search for it in another object, person or idea? What has happened here? From the point of view of the egoic mind, we have created an idea about something and then tried to hold that idea. We never could unify with that idea because the idea itself was just that, an idea. It itself is also impermanent and insubstantial. And thus we live a life chasing ghosts around the mind. This search in itself can make us feel quite ill. It can feel quite nauseating. The nauseating world of thinness. This is something you can actually become aware of sometimes in direct experience. Yeah? So it might manifest in moments when we get something that we've been wanting. Pick one for yourself. You know. Maybe you're into clothes, and I know I can get into them. Did that pair of shoes or that shirt make the change you were hoping for? Did it create the image of yourself that you hoped? Did it really get people to love and like you? Did it really improve your feeling of self-worth? Did the lover you managed to get do the same thing? From the point of view of the awakened mind or heart, the fact of insubstantiality and impermanence is not a problem. If we see what we thought of as substantial wasn't substantial, and it was the mind that was tricking us into believing this, as it were, then we are free from trying to find happiness somewhere where it can't be found. This, then, is an enormous relief to the mind, as it surrenders out of this deluded way of seeing things. But more than this, from the Buddhist perspective, the mind itself, us as we see ourselves, is also one of these ideas. Letting go of these is an even greater relief is we no longer have to keep acting, behaving, and worrying about a construct that doesn't exist except as a deluded idea. This relief is tremendous. So much of our energy goes into the chasing of phantoms that cannot be grasped. To see that they are just phantoms becomes like waking up from a bad dream, to realise that it was only a dream. So what does this leave us with? The world does not disappear, but the deluded idea of the world does. And the attempt to hold on to the sand that is passing through our fingers goes from being a terrifying idea into a beautiful experience, one of freedom and release. The heart that was trapped in this delusion is now free to love without wanting, and to be without needing to be. What is left is what is only what is inherent to the nature of things. What is left is only what is inherent to the nature of things. Awareness, emptiness, appearance without clinging, our own true nature, beyond words and concepts, yet utterly real. So one of the ways into this world is for us to go from the conceptually dominated experience of life to one based upon direct experience, what we could call the move from a conceptual way of relating to a more perceptual way of relating. Ultimately, of course, these are just more categories of the thinking mind. The thinking mind, the one we are used to most of the time, is by nature what is called dualistic. It constantly splits the world into subject and object. This is what creates our suffering, this splitting of the world into subject and object. And it builds a world out of these concepts and it lives in it, mistaking it for the real world. There is no real world of concepts from the point of view of the awakened mind. Concepts to the awakened mind are useful means to point beyond concepts, fingers to point at moons. Okay, so I hope this isn't going over our heads too much. There are some difficult ideas here, perhaps, especially if we're new to Buddhism.